Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to today's Mad Tech Podcast. I'm your host, John Still, head of content at ExchangeWire, and we've got three really interesting stories today, generally across broadcasting, with some news from Channel 4 on their use of AI, the BBC charging for their news and coverage in the US, and ISBA's warning around the NHS 10-year health plan and what that could mean for advertisers. To dissect these incredibly interesting stories, I am joined by Matt Broughton, ExchangeWire's research lead. Matt, welcome.
Hi, John. Great to be here as ever.
Delighted to have you as always. And our very special guest is Ella Britton from Media Plus. Ella, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you on the pod. And as I mentioned, some pretty spicy stories to get into today. So I'm going to kick us off with Channel 4. And Channel 4 has launched trials of AI-generated TV ads, collaborating with brands and production partners on this. The initiative is exploring AI's role in creative advertising, aiming to enhance personalization and efficiency. So AI is the hottest topic. I've just been in Cannes and then our event in Singapore, and it's all anyone really has been able to or wanted to talk about recently. And this is a really interesting move. So Ella, I'm going to start with you. Are AI ads the future?
I think yes. And I think that there's something that are going to really open up opportunities for smaller and medium-sized brands. That's the bit that I'm most excited about. I think that there are certain channels that those brands are unable to play in at the moment just because of costs. I know production is incredibly expensive, and if you're going to invest in it, you want to make it incredible. So what I see it doing in a really positive way is opening up channels like linear TV, VOD, SVOD, BVOD for these brands, which is really exciting. Obviously, I know there's an incredible amount of nervousness around people's jobs and the quality of these adverts. I know that the one we're speaking about today, that Channel 4 made, it's a good ad. I think obviously it could potentially be better, be worked on, but I know that they're in really, really early stages at the moment. And I think, you know, based on the budget that they had and the time that they had to create it, I think it's a pretty incredible output. But I think that in general, what I'm most excited about is opening it up for smaller brands, cutting times in half as well. And yeah, just producing things that are a little bit different.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up on two of your points there. I'm going to go for both the positive and the negative. I think the positive is the barrier of entry. I think you've touched on that. I spoke about it on a CTV panel recently and how it is allowing small, medium-sized brands to, like you said, play in those spaces is very, very interesting. Matt, how do you see that in terms of how ads can be made?
Yeah, I completely agree with you both there in terms of lowering that barrier to the smaller brands and actually letting them play in that CTV space where traditionally they haven't been able to, because obviously, you know, you're paying massive production budgets and then obviously having to pay for that ad slot itself. Obviously, you know, previously there has been criticism of AI in terms of, oh, it's a bit uncanny valley, production values aren't going to be great. But as Ella said, in terms of the Channel 4 concepts, and as we've been sharing around the office today, there's a concept advert for Liquid Death, which is, you know, realistic conversations, realistic people, pyrotechnics, which otherwise you'd have to spend either a fortune on in terms of having actual pyrotechnics or obviously special effects budget. And it's just, you know, It's a really positive thing for those smaller brands to be able to enter. Of course, on the flip side of that, though, you do run the risk of having the larger scaled public listed companies going for, we can cut corners here. And even though they've got the budgets and the capabilities to produce, you know, really high quality adverts and pay a lot of people to produce those adverts, so it could create potentially a race to the bottom, but ultimately, no, I think it is a positive thing for the brands and the smaller ones particularly.
Yeah, just picking up on that Liquid Death ad, it was so funny. It made me laugh so much. And it was done for $800, which is extraordinary. And I think it's called VO3, the technology that was used to create it. And what was incredible about it was it was prompts, obviously. So the creatives themselves were responsible for making the prompts. Yeah. So you still had that creative involvement. It just sped things up and was so cheap to create. I think that, you know, it's one of those things when you look at at some of their other ads that they've made, they do have the big budgets. So I do, that is my slight worry as well, is brands like Liquid Death using this, getting a lot of traction around it because they're sort of the first to do it. Now, it did look like AI. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, it's still got that kind of almost haze to it that suggests it is an AI video.
And I think they get away with that because that feels very on brand for them. I don't know how much the other kind of, you know, the bigger brands that have the legacy, that they would get away with it. For example, John Lewis, if they made an AI generated ad, I think we'd all be up in arms because we have different expectations. Whereas for a brand like Liquid Death, you sort of expect something a bit kooky and a bit off the wall. So this wasn't massively surprising to me, but I could definitely tell it was made with AI.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. Matt, you touched on the uncanny, which is a nice way of putting it. And Ella as well, you know, you said it is very, very good. The VO3 made Liquid Death ad. It's, you know, it's impressive and it's funny. Yeah. And, you know, the response in the office was kind of, oh, wow, we're all screwed here. Yeah. if it can do this, we're in trouble. But also, it's recognisably AI, and that's interesting. Do you envisage a future where, you know, this is going to be mass-produced, this is going to be the future? Do you think we're going to need, like, a little robot emoji in the corner to flag that it's AI-generated and we're going to have human-generated content and AI-generated content separately at different levels?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, I think that I was looking a little bit at the fashion industry because they're probably the industry that has taken this the most. They've been using AI since 2023, really, the bigger brands. A lot of kind of brands using AI to create really diverse models, and that's kind of the uptake of that has been earlier than I think what we're seeing for other brands. There is a label now that says made with AI or made by AI that I think we're gonna see a lot more of cropping up. I'm very intrigued to know whether we'll start having a bit of a disparity between, like, you know, if it's made with AI, it's judged as being a bit less than, and then the ones that are kind of made just kind of through us and through the kind of human touch, that will be regarded as a higher quality. I'm also fascinated to know whether at Cannes, for example, there's new categories where it's just AI-based categories. I'll be really intrigued to see that happen, but I think that it's only fair to label it saying made with AI. But then again, you know, if a production house has access to different types of technology, they don't have to put made using X, you know? So. Yeah.
And it kind of, I think, with AI technologies proliferating every single part of that production process, obviously, if you have a made with AI, is it a case of, oh, we just use AI to speed up some of the post-production versus it's pretty much all, like, the entire content is produced with AI? I think that distinction needs to be discussed and worked on. But yeah, it's a really interesting question as to how that would possibly be rolled out going forward.
Yeah, I mean, the point you make, you know, could we see a human premium for human-made content? Is this like organic groceries? This is, we've opened up a whole different kind of worms here. Ella, to finish on this one, you know, you are strategy director for Media Plus. How are you going to go about advising clients on AI ads and how they use AI?
Yeah, so we have done a huge amount of research into this. We've actually just published a new report. I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, but it's called the Renaissance, but it's the Renaissance because that's how it's spelled.
Nice. Very nice.
Thank you. So that human creativity coming in handy there. And this is basically looking at upskilling brands, businesses, and ourselves, and what we can do to kind of really level the playing field and make sure people are aware of the potential of AI and utilizing it to the highest standard. So that's something that we're speaking to a lot of our clients about at the moment. We do work with quite a lot of medium-sized brands, so I think this is going to be hugely impactful for us, just in terms of getting them onto channels that haven't been accessible to them in the past just due to budget constraints. So we're having quite a lot of conversations at the moment with certain brands that we work with about potentially turning up in those spaces. Those channels are still more expensive to buy in media, so there is still an accessibility kind of barrier. But I do think that if we do cut those production costs down, they're going to become way more widely available. But I think at the moment, we're still really in that education phase. So really getting people up to speed with the developments that are happening and really bringing our clients on that journey with us.
Nice. Exciting.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I think at the moment, there's still a novelty to it. People are still playing with it. But I'm going to be really excited to see what happens when people start to really master it and what it can do.
Nice. I'm very impressed by the Rene AIsense. Yeah. I love that. That's right on my street.
I hope that's right.
Sounds good. Amazing. Right. I'm going to move us on to our next story. This could be a bit controversial. The BBC will introduce a paid digital service in the US offering news and TV content to American audiences. Aimed at boosting commercial revenue, the subscription model will supplement existing international operations. This marks a strategic shift as the BBC seeks to monetize its global reputation and trusted journalism abroad. Matt, I'll chuck to you first here. Does this make sense for the BBC?
Yeah, I think so. I think domestically, there's always been rumblings about the future of the license fee. If it goes up, there's obviously any questions. Oh, is it good value anymore? So to actually, you know, look at them really quite massive international audiences, what there's like nearly 60 million US viewers of the BBC and of that content. And especially in the US, where obviously you've got kind of, you know, the more bipartisan nature of their news channels, they're looking more for that kind of unbiased content that the BBC produces, it makes sense to look to monetize that a bit more actively. And the pricing seems right fair to me. It's not as if it's, you know, an exorbitant, you're spending $20 a month plus on the content. It's £37 a year for that trusted content. I think the only, not drawback, but I think if obviously you've got, you know, you build up a quite active base of US subscribers, and if you then look to raise the price of that, they'll probably look for more US focused content, and then obviously you have to pay journalists to produce that content, so it kind of takes away that extra profit margin you're gaining from doing that. But overall, I think it's a sharp move by the BBC, and I think it'll pay off for them.
Nice. Ella, what do you think?
I'm in complete agreement. I think that it makes total sense. I think the audience is there. So a little bit different, but we helped launch BritBox. In the US, they currently still have around 3 million subscribers. So we know that there is such an appetite for British content out there. I think obviously this is quite different, but I think in the US, the BBC has such a strong reputation. And I think that now more than ever, we need that kind of unbiased news source. I'm fascinated to know what the uptake will be. I know that they've got quite a few, you know, really, really brilliant news sources out there. So the Washington Post, you've got the New York Times, and those do sit behind a paywall for more premium content. So it isn't something that will be very unique, but I think it is like the price point feels right. It is something that people might possibly pay for. My worry is that it's just going to be a very small number of people. I don't think they're really thinking about generations that are consuming news on social media. So Gen X, Gen Alpha, and millennials to a certain degree are not reading these sources as much as kind of older generations. So I worry about the sustainability of the model just because younger generations that are coming up are getting the majority of their news from social media.
Yeah, do you think it's not a last throw of the dice? That's a bit dramatic, but is it kind of getting the last few dollars before the audience goes completely social and BBC has to really change its news output?
100%. I really do think that this is like, if we don't do it now, this is not going to be a viable option for us, and we need to do it like immediately. I think just in terms of the climate, I think it's a good move. I think that people are really struggling to trust the news. And like I said, I think the BBC has a really, really strong reputation out there. So, you know, I think that it's a good move now. I just don't know how much long-term potential it has.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think the question of trust is a big one, actually. And, you know, part of this is the BBC monetizing its reputation. Ellie, you've just said it's, you know, it is trusted around the world. Wherever we go, whenever we speak at any conference, people know the BBC, trust BBC output. Matt, do you feel that that's going to, you know, play a big part in people really taking up this this new commercial offering?
Yeah, I think obviously it depends, you know, in terms of the wider landscape. If we, you know, have a Trump V2 after this current Trump presidency, then trust in news is going to be a major part. If it goes back to more sort of standard democratic ways in the US, then it may calm down a bit, and that plays less into the US subscribers' mindset. In terms of the BBC, obviously, in terms of how the license fee works, I think, you know, to Ella's point, it's good for now, but in terms of the future, with the future generations not necessarily absorbing news content in the same way, it's going to be an issue. But I think this move as well is quite a bit about optics. So the BBC is able to go, look, to obviously to domestic viewers in the UK, look, we're monetizing our overseas audiences as well. We don't have to put the license fee up. Look how well it's working for you guys. Whereas actually going forward, the argument may be weaker.
Yeah, Ella, it does, you know, it raises questions regarding the license fee, as many things do at the moment, sadly. Do you think this kind of brings more scrutiny on the BBC's commercial arm?
I completely agree. I think it's one of those things that if they didn't do something like this, everyone's just going to kick off anyway. So they had to do something. They had to do something that feels far enough away that it doesn't impact them. So I think that this is a very strategic move, you know, we're not charging you more. We're charging people in the US. I think that it's... the costs are high enough? No, I think that they should be charging a lot more. And I think that kind of, if they did that, I think then people would go, okay, this, you know, this makes sense. I think that, you know, paying the license fee is fine and it's fair, because, you know, we're getting this supported by elsewhere. But yeah, I think that it's a very strategic move. It hasn't been confirmed yet, so they're still in talks, you know, about it. It's a fairly new announcement, so I'd be interesting to see if it even goes through, to be honest.
Yeah, interesting. Well, at least we've covered the issues in case it does go through. We won't have to revisit.
If it doesn't, we'll have to find a new story to chat about.
We'll do a part two.
Well, it's our annual check-in on the license fee and BBC commercial situation. Yeah, I mean, I think the BBC's model is still fascinating. And, you know, they make an awful lot of money from stuff like Bluey, of all things. You know, it's become a worldwide sensation. But no, very interesting to see them take this approach to monetizing. And I like your point, Ella, regarding it being far enough away.
Yeah. You
know, so over in the States, I'm going to move us on to our final story. And this is, again, an interesting one. ISBA has warned that the NHS's 10-year health plan could expand restrictions under the less healthy food rules. More brands may face tighter advertising limits if product criteria broaden. The groups urged clarity and collaboration to avoid overregulation, which is balancing public health goals and advertisers' ability to promote responsibly. Ella, I'm going to come to you first on this one. First of all, are these rules a good thing for the public, and how should advertisers really be approaching this?
So... yes, of course, they're definitely good for the public. I think that, you know, there is a bit of an epidemic in terms of less healthy food being advertised to kids specifically. And this is why these rulings kind of came out. It was all around advertising to kids and also the accessibility of less healthy food. So having them on ILNs when the major, you know, and having them in lots of different locations. You know, a lot of snacks and unhealthy food are picked up in secondary locations. So trying to reduce that physical availability or concentrate it down certain aisles is a very specific and strategic move. And I really, really buy into the fact that this is something we need. However, this has been a complete nightmare for brands and businesses because it just keeps changing. So, you know, even the name, it was HFSS, now it's less healthy foods. The rules are changing constantly. So, you know, initially it was all content. You know, you couldn't advertise all content. Now it's okay, you can advertise your brand, but just not the products. Oh, if you're an SME, you can do anything you want. You can advertise it all. You can't be on social media, but if it's your own social channels, that's fine. It's so murky, it's so confused, and it's changing all the time. I think it's absolutely right, but I think people just need to pull themselves together and make a choice, because it's been delayed, it's been moved, the goalposts have changed, and I don't think it's clear enough for brands and businesses to understand it. And then this ruling has come in now, so the NHS are reviewing, and that might change the goalposts again. And I just think, you know, when it's a really good thing and everyone's, you know, behind it, but then it keeps changing and it keeps amending, and it's just become a bit of a nightmare, to be honest.
Yeah, it sounds it. Yeah. I mean, the key thing here, I think, is overregulation, which we're trying to point at. And that, to your point, you know, they first of all need to decide what they are regulating and how they are framing it, which is interesting. And Matt, how do you feel about this?
Yeah, completely agree with Ella's points there. Like, it's no one is arguing against the spirit of these reforms, and actually looking, you know, through this bloody long 10-year plan for the NHS, none of them are actually like really jumping out as, oh, this is a bad idea. It's just restricting junk food advertising at children. It's kind of continuation from rules that are already being brought in. So no problem there. Uplifting the soft drinks industry levy and introducing some more reporting for healthy food sales. None of that people are arguing with. But in terms of what does mandatory reporting mean? What is the actual minutiae of this legislation for advertisers? Because, like you say, they've been pulled from pillar to post so often. It's just like, what will it actually be? And I think absorbing these, you know, new rules for advertisers as part of a 10-year plan for the NHS, which is obviously just a mind-bogglingly big task in and of itself, you're going to have that more uncertainty on top of that. So I think it's absolutely right that ISBA's stepped in and been like, hang on a minute, there are serious concerns here. Yeah. And yeah, they're absolutely right to raise those concerns.
And I just feel like it's almost like we need a manual, because some of it just really doesn't make sense. So, and it'll probably change when this podcast is launched. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's probably going to change in the next 10 minutes. I think the thing that I don't understand is, you know, out of home. No, you know, you're not allowed to do some formats of out of home, but digital out of home is absolutely fine. Audio, no issues there. You can be on the radio while kids are going to school in the morning. You can still be on the radio, but we can't do TV or VOD. You know, you've got to do a watershed. It's post 9 p.m. So logically, it's just not stacking up for me. And I'm trying to, you know, process all of this and help brands and our clients do this, because we've got a lot of clients in this space. And like I said before, it's just a complete minefield and illogical. And that's, I think, some of the things that I'm struggling with, is saying, well, hang on, why can you get kids on the way to school doing the school run on radio, but, you know, on TV, everything's, you know, banned and you know, you can't show them anything, you know, before 9 p.m. It's just not making sense to me.
And it really like hamstrings those brands in the sense that obviously now you're looking more towards, you know, multi-channel campaigns, yeah, measuring across those channels. And like you say, if you know, you're able to do it on radio, you're able to do it on YouTube, but only if it's not signed into a child's account,
yeah,
then it's just so many rabbit warrens and loopholes that for any advertiser, it must be an absolute nightmare to get their heads around.
Definitely. Yeah, it feels like whoever's making the rules, it's a bit of a whack-a-mole approach. Yeah. I mean, probably
they've got a dartboard. Oh no, digital out of home, fine, but we've missed the radio board, so that's all good for now.
It's like, oh no, there's another one. Well, I think I'll call it a day for our discussion there. We've gone through a few fairly tasty topics. Ella, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciated you coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
No, you're very welcome. Matt, always, thank you.
Thanks, John. Pleasure as ever.
And thank you all very much for listening.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.